Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, made in France since 1925. The first and finest enameled cast iron cookware, a favorite for generations. For more information, visit lecreuset.com. That's LECREUSET.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. The topic? Restaurants and rules. Some rules are based on religion.
This makes for an unusual scene in a Manhattan restaurant. A shy 20-year-old dictating the kitchen standards to a humble veteran chef.
While other rules promote health and safety.
But who are these feared rule keepers with the power to shut a restaurant down?
They're not really like food lovers.
Some restaurant rules fall outside the domain of the kitchen.
All civil rights issues have basically, at one point or another, revolved around the bathroom.
For more, tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Darren Bresnitz, sitting here with Mark Vetri and Vetri Cucina.
Cucina.
Nailed it. Nailed it on the first take.
Not really, but, you know.
It's nice to be on your home turf. I mean, Philadelphia is your turf.
Philly's awesome, man. I love it here.
It's one of the best. You know, it's coming back, especially from L.A., especially during this time of year when it's, like, crisp and sort of gray and everything's changed. You go, like, oh, I sort of miss these seasons a lot.
It is a little rainy out now.
Yeah.
It's been raining a lot, so it hasn't... We've kind of, like... went right from the summer to the winter, and we sort of like missed the fall.
Yeah, I found that that's been a trend of the Northeast for the last few years.
Yeah.
Big question. Now that you got the pizza cookbook at, have you helped, or do you think the Philadelphia pizza town, can you say officially on the map as a pizza town?
Oh, we're definitely
America?
A pizza town here, man. We've got some awesome. I mean, obviously. You know, the ones that I open, but we got a slew of other ones. More that I mean,
I was Lorenzo really and Sons guy growing up.
Lorenzo and Sons, yeah, they're old school.
I remember
huge slices.
What?
Huge slices.
Like, and only toppings, I think, once a week.
Yeah.
You were a Rizzo's guy, right?
I was a Rizzo's guy. That was actually in the. Yeah. So you read the book?
Nice. I did read the book.
Like that.
You know,
not everyone knows Rizzo's. And you have to read the book.
Yeah. You got
to
read the book.
So it's not there now, but that was it, man. 40 years ago, yeah.
So for people who are not familiar with Philadelphia-style pizza, and we can just start with the slice, like how would you describe a Philly slice?
I don't know that it exists, you know? I just think it's like very similar to the old fashioned one from New York.
Yeah.
Just like large, you know,
thin crust,
but really sort of, you know,
airy as
floppy,
well.
I would say. Like a floppy crust, real heavy, you know, the mozzarella and the sauce kind of all like run, you know, together.
A little sweet.
Sweetness. Some oregano. I think oregano is kind of the major flavor there.
Now, you've been making pizza for about 30 years.
Is this okay?
Yeah, that's fine. We're in a restaurant.
Okay.
Get into it, but it's like jazz, baby, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know what? You actually started making pizza out on the West Coast with I would say the man who probably changed pizza
Wolfgang
for the West
Puck.
Coast, Wolfgang Puck.
Yeah.
How did you what was it like when you first started making pizza, and especially pizza professionally? What was like the change internally?
I fell in love with it. I mean, I had never really like made it like that, you know, like mixing everything, letting it actually rise, the whole fermentation, the wood oven, you know, they only use the wood oven then, so I had to learn, like, you know, how to stick the logs on, where the heat, you know, where to have the logs and everything, the heat, how to like rotate it around. So that was a whole, and I just like fell in love with that. I always, you know, wanted to work that the station. I just loved it.
Now, had you done pasta? Like, hey, you sort of mastered pasta at that point.
Well, mastered. No, I was learning
pasta, but
I was learning pasta.
So, you know, you
still learning pasta.
Still learning pasta, like, which is
every day.
So, but you know, it's like you have dough. At some point, you have your dough,
yeah,
and then you go in completely different directions of in the actual cooking process.
Sure.
Were there any skills that you were pulling from pasta for cooking, or was it just completely different mindset?
You know, so I was out there in the early 90s, you know, and that was kind of like my school, you mm-hmm. know, for everything, really. You know, I used to, you know, when I worked for Wolf, I was really still like learning my way around the restaurant. You know, I hadn't went to Italy yet, you know, so I was just learning how to like make a stock, fillet a fish, make a sauce, you know, all that, you know, so learning that there just, you know, sort of added to everything, and it was just for me, like, that was like the nuts and the bolts of everything, you know. So I was just fascinated with learning and just putting that all, you know, together and making things. For me, that was just super fascinating.
Now, we'll get into it a little bit later, because some of the combinations you have at your pizza restaurant and in the book are non-traditional. Mm-hmm. And you were learning pizza at the place where non-traditional toppings, especially at a gourmet level, were started.
Did you traditional toppings, though, but
the dough itself, yeah, and everything. Did you find that as an influence? Like, do you think that if you had learned pizza somewhere else, that wouldn't have
been? No, because I always went, you know, once I went to Italy, I really learned about flavors and what, like, works with what, you know. So I think, it, like, you know, just that was, for me, that was just reps, you know. Rolling out the dough, sticking it in the oven. Rolling out the dough, sticking it in the oven. We do
just the volume,
man. Yeah, we used to do 400 every single like night. I was rolling out dough, putting it in the oven. I used
how about those forearms? Those forearms getting big.
300, 400 of those things every single night. So, I mean, that was my, like, that was the reps, you know. So, you have to have that. You know, that was an amazing foundation for me to have. I was very lucky to have that opportunity there. So, but once I went, you know, to Italy, then I started to understand flavors and simplicity and what sort of worked with what. And then I could start, you know, saying, hey, you know, those things that I was making with, like, you know, when I was out in LA, a lot of that stuff doesn't really make sense for me now. I would leave off this, that, and the other thing, and I would only use this, you know. So, you know, that's when, you know, so I started to kind of put it all together, I think, later.
I mean, you've made many trips to Italy, especially for research and pasta.
I mean, I used to go twice a year now.
So. But that first trip, what was one of the things when you got over there that disrupted everything you had thought about pizza? What was one or two things that you said, oh, I had no idea that it could be like this, or I just had a different perception?
Well, I mean, again, you're specifically talking, I mean, I mean, about that one item, right? I look at it as I learned about food there and like flavors and what worked with what. Then you can, you know, use that for anything, you know. So I wasn't really focused on, you know, when I went to Italy, I didn't really learn a lot about that. I just learned a lot about food and flavors and, respecting the land and, you know, where everything arrives from and all of that stuff. And then, you know, once you have that knowledge, you can use it anywhere, right? You don't have to, you know, specifically, you know, say, oh, I'm like using it for fish, or I'm using it for meat, or I'm using it for noodles, or I'm using it for pizza making. You know, it's knowledge that you can just utilize for everything.
I want to skip ahead a little bit because you come back to America, you go to New York, you wind up in Philly, you have, you know, the restaurant we're sitting in now, a few places. But what made you want to start opening a pizza restaurant? When did you start saying that I'm ready, I've mastered it, I have something to say differently? Because, you know, artisanal wood fire pizza now is, I don't want to say common ground, but it's easier to find in almost any city than it was maybe at 5 years or 10 years ago. What was that shift for you?
First of all, even though the book is actually named Mastering, we have to stop using that word in terms of like that I have like mastered anything in my life.
No, of course.
But I haven't. I mean, I'm always learning. It's a great
tool.
It's a great tool, but you know, it's...
When did you feel confident enough that your
pizza... It's really unmastering pizza is, you know, really should be the name of the book. So we opened the Osteria, and obviously, we had the oven there, and we had a whole like section where we had our Roman style pizzas on the menu there, and you know, we were just always kind of talking like we should just open up a restaurant with only this on the menu, just like six pizzas, and like that's it. And we were always kind of talking about it, and then just like, you know, how anything happens, you know, the guy who was the landlord from Amice was redoing this other thing where he was, you know, having like 100 rental units, and he had some retail under it, and he had this one little 1600 square foot thing that he didn't know what to stick there.
Right.
You know, so I looked at it and I was like, man, this is perfect for a wood oven and like that's it. You know, so you know, we started looking at it and I was like, let's just make it, dude. Let's just call it, you know, Pizzeria Vetri, and let's just knock it out. And then we started, you know, working on the concept and we just came up with like 8 or 9, I don't remember how many were on the menu. And then we kind of came up with the Rotolo, and we just knocked it out, you know?
Now, for people who don't know what the Rotolo is, because I would feel remiss if we didn't mention, what is your addition to pizza lexicon? And inventions, because it's
a Cinnabon.
It's basically like a Cinnabon, but it's...
But a savory one, like stuff with like mortadella and ricotta, and I wanted to have something on the menu that just wasn't like the norm. So we started messing around with things and started rolling them around, and we just kind of came up with that.
My mom loved it.
Good.
My mom.
That's all that counts.
Right? Yeah, that's all that counts.
That's it, man. Loves it. That's it.
But we're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk about the cookbook, putting that together, and then we're going to talk about the opening of Las Vegas.
Okay.
We have a song from the archives. You know what? We'll play one of your songs from our archives with you playing on it.
Well, one of the Phil Roy ones.
The Phil Roy ones. Yeah. And then we'll come right back with Mark Vetri. You're listening to Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
It's called Exceptionally Ordinary. A little blues thing. Oh, the pigeons are cooing outside my front door. I never heard them sound so pretty before. The neighbor's baby's crying, it's time to be fed. The morning light's calling, get yourself out of bed. There's poetry to see in the exceptionally ordinary. Well, I stumble to the sink, let the water splash my eyes. I glance out the window, look at that war women sky. An old man is walking hand in hand with his wife, and I'm just a witness to the glories of life. There's poetry to see in the exceptionally ordinary. Oh, the sun turns light in the shadows, the sound of a bird's simple song, the smell of spring and its flowers. My baby waiting there for me when I get home. Now, who needs fancy eating when you got rice and beans? A simple glass of water, sure tastes sweet. There's poetry to see in the exception, the ordinary. Yeah, take it. Turns light in the shadows, the sound of a bird's simple song, the smell of spring and its flowers, my baby waiting there for me when I get home. Now most people, they don't notice what's good in this life. It ain't the love of money or the stuff that it buys. You won't find it in a store shelf or in a catalog of things. It's friendships, relationships, and family. There's poetry to see in the exceptionally ordinary. I know it, yeah. There's poetry to see in the exceptionally ordinary. Yeah, I know it, I know it, yeah. There's poetry to see in the exceptionally ordinary.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I'm here with Mark Vetri, and we are talking about the new pizza cookbook.
Listening to some of your old jam. Yeah, I haven't heard that in a while.
I know. It's a classic. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
So now that you have, it's four locations, right, of the pizza place?
Well, so, you know, I don't own them anymore.
Right.
You know that, right? So, yeah. So, they're not really mine, but yes. The Urban Outfitter folks have.
The Urban Outfitter folks
have. Two here, one in Washington, and one at the mall here. Yeah, so, yeah.
So, what made you, now that you had the stores, you sold them, but, like, you opened it up, what made you want to write a cookbook? Like, you know, it's one thing to open a restaurant mm-hmm. that serves pizza, but another thing to sort of put your knowledge into a book. And I will say this, it is a very comprehensive book, and what I love about it is that it's, you say, like, there's no wrong or right way to do it. It's pizza. You know, and you just to try it, and just to keep trying, and keep trying, and keep trying.
I mean, so, you know, this is obviously my fourth book.
Yeah.
And you know, I just wanted to write it, you know, because I think that all of the other things, you know, so obviously, like, read a lot of others, and I'm always kind of seeing this one, you know, here's the one
one recipe. Dough.
Here's the one dough.
One dough to rule them all. Dough. Yeah.
Here's my dough.
Here's one sauce.
And I'm like thinking to myself, you know, like that's just wrong. And it's not going to work for everyone. And, you know, the more that I like worked out of like various ovens and like, you know, I just started to think about, you know, you really have to look at first your heat source.
Yeah.
You know, because a 900, a 900 degree oven and a 500, you know, degree oven is certainly going to make a totally different result, right?
Yeah.
And so is there a way to add hydration into things and like figure out ways to mimic a 900 degree oven in a store bought like the Lowe's 500 degree oven, or is there some other way to use like an iron skillet, or if you have what's it called, the egg,
the
big green egg,
yeah,
can you make something in that? So we just like started messing around with all these different heat sources and different hydration levels, and we started to come up with a variety of different mixes that worked in all of these ovens, you know, and it just started to make sense. And like, and that's always, you know, like when I was in Los Angeles years ago, it was all for me, everything, you know, I'm someone who understands like this is the round thing, this goes in the round hole,
yeah.
You know, I'm like very mechanical,
yeah,
you know, in my thinking ways, you know, so I'm like, you know, all about like logics and like this has to work and science, you know, so you know, 900 degrees, you can use, you know, 60%, you know, hydration levels in that, but at 500, you know, you're gonna have to raise that,
mm-hmm,
in order for it to work. But you have to understand why. So you have to understand what happens when you stick it in the oven, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it,
you know, so
it,
I went through all that, yeah, in the book, so folks will understand that, not just like here's the recipe, make this, but why.
Yeah, I mean, the book is a really good, especially when it comes to baking, and I found a lot of cookbooks, yeah, the why is left out a, yeah, lot of the time.
Yeah.
And it was really nice to read this book because it is both, it's a very forgiving and understanding, mm-hmm, book that you are not going to have a 900, yeah, degree wood oven. But if you do, congratulations, you can go,
sure,
to this section.
That's great.
But if you have a 500 degree oven and you, yeah, don't, and you didn't want to make the investment in a pizza stone, that's fine. But you know, flip over your baking sheet and you can use that instead. But it definitely is encouraging that, saying with each level and each investment, each, yeah, time you make that dough, absolutely, it's going to get better.
Absolutely, yeah.
One of my favorite sections in it is where you can pair pizza to jazz. And, yes, it's one of my favorite, I would say, food music analogies, yeah, that I've seen. But where do you see the connection? How did you come up with that analogy?
You know, I don't remember exactly, because I mean, obviously, all this stuff sort of flows,
mm-hmm,
flows, you know, together. And I'm also older now, so I forget half of the half of the shit I write. But for me, it's always been about a melodic sense, you know. And food is also like that, you know. So I always kind of think of using, you know. You know, when I started studying the music when I was out in, you know, Los Angeles, I was always fascinated with the guys who could make two notes sound incredible.
Yeah.
You know, and you never understood why, because I could like use those exact notes and it'd be like, ding, ding, but they did it, and it was like, oh my God, what were those notes? Yeah. They were just notes, but the way they played them was incredible. And then I would listen to the guys that could like riff like 30 notes in the same amount of time that, you know, someone like, you know, Miles would do two notes, and I'd be like, I'd rather listen to Miles Davis all day long than to listen to whoever else do 30 notes in the same amount of time. And I kind of think of food like that, like two things on a plate. Yes, there's a pickup. I'm sorry, it's downstairs.
Do you know? Sorry.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, pick it. No, it's all good.
You know, so.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I just wanted to make sure you got the right thing.
We're still going?
Yeah, keep going. Okay,
yeah, so, I mean, I was always kind of fascinated with that. And that's the way I kind of think about food. Even like now, Black Hooks, you know, they say, hey, chef, look at this. And there'll be, you know, 20 things on there and everything like mass. And I'm like, yeah, why don't you take this off? And, you know, there ought to be 2 to 3 flavors that, you know, sort of help one another. They don't like mask the other. They don't hide the other. They sort of, you know, complement one another. And that's the same that I think of like some of the most amazing soloists out there.
Yeah, it's about the harmonies and about editing, which just comes with age and repetition. Now, before we move on to Vegas, I want to ask one more question about the book, because there's so much information in there. Like, it's a dense information. But what is the one piece of advice, or one of the top pieces of advice, after doing all this research, writing this book, that you would offer to someone who wants to start making pizza at home?
I would say, don't be scared by it. I mean, that's the one thing that I think everyone, you know, they just think about flour and like mixing, and they automatically think, oh my God, we're gonna make a mess, it's never gonna rise. They don't know whether to leave it in the refrigerator or out of the refrigerator. And it just, once you overcome that, you know, because that's always, I'm never going to try this, I'm just going to make a mess, you know, it's going to be too watery, it's never going to come together. But once you, like, get over that hump of, you know, like, it takes, like, 10 minutes to mix, you know, it's all it is flour, water, salt, and yeast, that's it. You know, flour, water, salt, yeast. Yeah, and like some, you add some olive oil, you know, and then you can have some flavors, this and that, but flour, water, salt, yeast. Mix them together and let science happen.
Sit back.
And that's it,
So if releasing Mastering Pizza wasn't enough at this time, you've also decided to open up a restaurant, The Palms in Vegas.
Yes.
And opening restaurants of notable chefs who don't live in Vegas, because chefs really are from Vegas.
Yeah.
How did that process start? What made you want to go to Vegas? And how did you think that you could sort of recreate this intimate townhouse experience in, you know, the Palms?
Yeah, well, I think it was a multitude of, like, just kind of happenings. You know, I was obviously, you know, with Urban Outfitters, and I was thinking of, you know, of leaving there. I was there for about 2 years after we, you know, sort of sold the company. And, you know, I was left with this one restaurant here. And they were redoing the hotel.
Yeah.
And I think Simon was the first one to sign on, and he had just recently opened the Atlantic City restaurant, Angelina.
Yeah.
And you know, they were kind of talking to him, and they said, you know, we have this awesome spot on the 56th floor. It's really small. We want you to do this really fine dining food from Italy, like you're doing in Atlantic City. And as the story goes, you know, I think Michael, he said this to me. He said, "I'm not doing that restaurant. Like, you're gonna call Mark Vetri right now, you know." And you know, so they were like, "All right," you know. So one day they ate at, I think they were visiting Michael, and they're like, "Hey, why don't we shoot down the Vetri?" So they.
As one does, right? Just goes.
We're 45 minutes from Atlantic City.
Yeah.
It's really easy. They ate at the restaurant. They were just blown away. And they went back to Vegas, and they were just like, "We got to get this guy in here," you know. And then you know, we started the negotiations from there.
I mean, it's a beautifully designed restaurant because. From the photos, it doesn't feel like a Vegas restaurant.
It does not. It feels actually, and you know, obviously, we just opened up. We had a whole bunch of nights. It really feels like Vetri Philly.
Which is
amazing. But then you happen to look out the window and you see the Vegas Strip. And I got to tell you, I mean, just a small little, I mean, an analogy, you know. And, you know, whoever's listening to this can sort of take this any way that they want to take it. But hanging out there, so there's always been like, right, you know, we're Philly.
Mm-hmm.
New York's an hour and whatever, yeah. 20 minutes from us. And we've always been like, you know, Philly, you know, you want to go to the city, you're going to New York.
Right.
When in reality, you know, if you ask me, the city is Center City, Philadelphia.
Yeah.
But, you know, so we've always kind of been sort of second fiddle to New York, right? And, like, when I was there, you know, so we had this awesome view of the Strip, and we're sort of off of it, you know. And I sort of feel like the Strip is New York, but we're still in Philly at the hotel.
Yeah,
you know, sort of feels like a little bit like, hey, there's the Strip. Fuck you, you know. Like we're here, you know, and we're doing our thing.
But it's funny because the New York representation there is so gaudy and this like weird,
you know, some of them are,
but like the New York casino
with, yeah
this weird.
But I think I actually will say, because I was actually just there, and I was actually at the Nomad open.
Oh yeah.
And you know, and they're thinking about this the same way,
mm-hmm.
that I'm thinking about it. Let's and I think a lot of like folks, they're gonna start to order to open up, like, I think less Vegas-y style. Like, it looked like Nomad in,
oh yeah,
New York, and it was awesome, and it felt like small but like hip, and you know, I think we feel like that, and I think a lot of these new restaurants, they're gonna open up, but they're gonna feel like that, you know, like they want to make, I think, a less, you know, Vegas-y style restaurant out there now.
So in opening up it, and from the sort of the menu, mm-hmm. and developing the approach, it still is Vegas. So did you have to change anything, or is it really just said, you know what we're doing in Philly, we're going to do that exactly in Vegas?
You know, we're going to figure things out. Like, obviously, you can order there, whereas, you know, here, there isn't any ordering, you know.
Yeah.
We have the menu for you. But that's the old Vetri. So we're basically opening up the Vetri that I opened up with here.
Right.
You know, which is, you know, you just order, here's a menu. You know, but other than that, there's no real changes. It's very similar to what we started, you know, here with our first 15 years.
Awesome. And is the wine list any different? Do you have those, like,
well,
in Vegas?
Well, I mean, you got to remember,
you're in Vegas.
Our state is a state-run wine system, so it's very difficult to get, like, really amazing wine. Vegas, we have an incredible wine list, and, like in the hotels, you have access to anything in the hotel. So all the other restaurants' wine list, we have access to all that stuff. So they could order some, we have the Scotch 80 downstairs.
Yeah.
From us, which is the steak restaurant. Man, they have incredible wines on their list. If someone walked upstairs like, hey, we saw the wine on the wine list there. You know, this 19 whatever.
Yeah.
Mouton Rothschild, we can make a phone call and they'll just kind of send it up, and then they'll send us the wholesale cost for it, and we'll just move it over to the restaurant, and then we'll get the sale. So, I mean, it's a whole different world out there.
Yeah. What's next? More Vetries, more books?
No more Vetries.
This is it.
That's it, man. I got it. Vetri East Coast, Vetri West Coast, and
we can't tempt you to come out to LA. Maybe
Las Vegas is as far as I'm getting. You know,
we tried to get him west of Nevada. He wouldn't do it.
No.
Well, Chef, I want to thank you so much. Congratulations on the book. I can't wait to check back in a year about Vegas and hear some more stories.
Thanks for having it.
Absolutely. We have another song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Cherry, cherry, still. That's not the beginning. Come on, cherry, cherry, still.
Pick up the phone.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni, the host of Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. When I'm not making food radio, I'm making food. And my favorite cookware is the 9-inch cast iron Le Creuset fry skillet that never leaves my stovetop. My Le Creuset recipe? Slab of bacon and some vegetables in the skillet. There is no better skillet than Le Creuset for my kind of skillet cooking. It spoils me. The heat retention is amazing. Heat a tortilla on super low heat. I even take my Le Creuset skillet with me when I travel. Bacon, quesadillas, burgers, chicken cutlets. Chefs always talk about sourcing the best quality ingredients, knowing your suppliers, using the right cookware and tools is just as important. Head to lecreuset.com/HRN. That's LECREUSET.com to see all the new products and amazing holiday gift deals. HRN listeners will get 20% off the new Le Creuset cookbook with the code HRN.
All right. If future irons are coming to your town, I would highly recommend seeing them. It's a very interesting, amazing group out of Baltimore Good Life Show. But Eli, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
I mean, I really think it has been like 4 or so years since you... You were here.
I think, well, the last time I was here was right before my last album came out, which unfortunately was 4 years ago, which is really crazy to think about. But now I've got a new record coming out, and here we are back again. This is all my promotional stop.
No, I mean, hey, I mean, I'll take it. Hopefully it won't be like 4 years to the next one, but
I would hope not.
So let's talk about the record.
Sure, man.
Tell us about it. I mean, recorded almost a year ago.
Yeah.
I know you recorded with like one of your longtime collaborators. You know, what was the approach on this one versus, you know, the previous records?
Well, you know, I mean, it took 4 years sort of for a reason. After I did my record for Capitol, which is Come and Get It in 2010, and we really, you know, I didn't even really take a break from touring. I stopped touring, recorded it in 4 weeks or whatever, and then went right back on the road. So we were literally touring almost from late 2007 through 2012, like without really any long extended breaks of more than a month or two. You know, it was a really extensive period of touring, which is great, you know, and I was really excited. And after that kind of tapered off, you know, I was ready to do another record for Capitol, and then they got bought out by EMI was bought out by Universal, and things kind of went to hell, and they didn't renew my contract at Capitol. And my buddy Mike Elizondo, who produced Come and Get It, basically right then, same week, called me and said, would you like to make a record for Warner Brothers? I just got this deal being a staff producer at Warner Brothers. They let me have an A&R job, which basically means he gets to sign acts. And I was his first call. He's like, hey, come and make a record at Warner Brothers. And I was like, okay, you know, can I do it myself, you know? And they were like, yeah, everybody was really supportive of me, and we had a few songs that were already written, but not all of it. And sort of from that, we took myself, when I say we, I'm always talking about myself and my friend Ryan Spraker, who was my guitarist for a long time and has now become my right-hand man for production and writing and just about everything. We took a bunch of trips out to Los Angeles and did writing sessions with a whole host of different writers and different kinds of writers, from a hip-hop producer to a rock producer to a rock songwriter, just to kind of see how people wrote songs, because I had been just used to just sitting at home with my acoustic guitar and, you know, I'd bang it out, and I wouldn't really, like, you know, I was sort of, like, still under the sway of, like, if I can't get it done in 7.5 minutes, then it's not a good song. And I kind of was gradually starting to move away from that and writing from, you know, however these guys wrote. So some guys were like, oh man, I got this sick, you know, drum beat, let's try to build something around that, or this bass line has been rolling around in my head, let's work from that, or this synth line, or this whatever, this vocal melody. So that was like a whole different idea of how to make a record, how to write a song, that sort of kind of changed my whole approach. And because of that, it was a little bit of a trial and error, and we wrote probably somewhere on the order of 40 songs for this record that ended up being 11,
right?
11 songs. But the process was honestly sort of the best part, you know. And when it came to actually record the record, so much of it in a way was already done because we had been demoing things more aggressively, and it was like, okay, we just got to put the finishing touches on this, and then it's ready to go.
And what were some of the, I mean, again, like the same thing with Eduardo, like what were some of the like aha moments you got from the writing process that have maybe stuck with you and will continue to influence you?
I think the biggest thing, I worked a lot actually with a guy, Michael Fitzpatrick, who people know as Fitz from Fitz and the Tantrums, mm-hmm. who's the lead singer, you know, and he is really like, he has a very particular style, and sometimes we don't get along when it comes to writing, but we wrote...
In what way?
Just, like, he's very set in his how he feels a song should be built or whatever, and just, like, he has a style.
Got it.
He has a style, and I have a style, and sometimes you might think that those two things, we would butt heads, and we did a little bit, but in a way, it was very good, because... What he really stressed to me was that vocal melody was something that you have to have a vocal melody that's going to catch people's attentions right away. And for me, coming as a background from as really a soul singer or coming from gospel music, and most of the singers that I love and the songs that I love from that era, the records that I love, aren't really about vocal melody. They're more about the virtuosity of the singers and like kind of like the power of the singers. Like you could just make anything a soul record by just like, if you have a good enough soul, like you see, listen to Wilson Pickett sing Hey Jude. He doesn't really sing the melody. He sings like Wilson Pickett. You know what I mean? And that's sort of what makes it him. But Fitz's idea and an idea that I eventually came around to was that you can sing that same way, but if you set the melody up, if you adhere strictly to the melody, then you're going to be able to catch people's ears more and get people on board faster to your songs.
Wow, I never thought about it that way. Do you have an example for anything?
It's hard, you know. I think a lot of the songs on this record, which is called Nights Like This, by the way, and it comes out April 29th.
Oh, we're gonna plug the shit out of it. Like, sure. Oh, that's one of ten.
One of ten. Yeah. So it is. You know, I think really most of them were we really focused on the melody even more than. I mean, I was such a words guy, and I still am. And I think the I mean, I'm very interested in making sure the lyrics are right. But we, you know, agonized over making sure the melody was like, it really hit home, like right away, like that was in your head, you know.
Do you want to
from the get go?
Do you want to play us a tune, a good example of this?
Sure. Well, I'm going to play. This is the first single. We did Woohoo, which you played earlier, which is kind of like our sort of teaser single. It was a little bit of a pre-launch. And this is the first one that's going to go to radio, hopefully already on the radio in Europe. And then hopefully we'll be on the radio here in the U.S. In the late spring, early summer. And this is called Shock to the System. This is one that I wrote with Fitz and Ryan and a great rock producer by the name of Dave Bassett.
Great.
Actually, I just want to say really quick, this is the first song that we wrote for this record. And the first session that we ever did, got out there with Fitz and Dave and banged this out in 4 or 5 hours, and I had no idea if it was good or not, and apparently people like it, so that's good. This is called Shock to the System.
She walked in my life and turned it upside down. I hollered, hey, hey, hey. Serious about her, but she made me a clown. I hollered, hey, hey, hey. I was feeling lost, I didn't know how I could be found. I hollered, hey, hey, hey. Oh, she set me straight and put my feet on the ground. I hollered, hey, hey, hey. I was skipping like a record, a song on repeat, till she flipped the 45 and knocked me off my feet. Shock to the system, kick to the rhythm, jump start the beat of my heart. Got what I'm missing, a high voltage kissing, turn me on and there's no chatting me off. Oh, 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 oh. They said they couldn't tell if I was dead or alive. I hollered, hey, she pulled me out the water and she let me survive. I hollered, hey, hey, hey. I was skipping like a record, a song on repeat. Chelsea flipped the 45 and knocked me on my feet. Ow! Like a shock, shock to the system, kick to the rhythm, jump start the beat of my heart.
Awesome.
Thank you.
That was great. So when you're putting a song together like that with five people, how does it come together? How does it not fall into like death by committee or lowest common denominator?
It's funny, you know, you would think that it would. You really would. And these were the first sessions that I had done with like more than one other person. I think everybody kind of finds their role. You know, in that particular session, I was really the one focused on the lyrics and kind of like making the lyrics and vocal melody fit together and making it my own because it's my voice. And then Dave was kind of building the track. You know, that's the thing with writing songs these days. You can come out of a session in 4 hours with something that sounds like kind of a finished product, which is really bizarre for me. And I never really... I would always like send in demos with just me and a guitar, you know. So, you know, part of writing the song is making it sound like a record already. So Dave was working on the drums, and then Fitz was building the kind of keyboard lines and making sure the harmony all fit together. And then, you know, I know Ryan and I were kind of working on the lyrics and melody together. You just it becomes like a team, and if you work together well, then you're a winning team, and if you don't, then you're a losing team.
Yeah, I mean, did you have any like sessions that you walked into where you're just like, this is not going well. We need to get out of here.
Absolutely. You know, I'm not going to name any names.
No, I mean, but we never do here.
Yeah,
but.
You know, I mean, some sessions are just busts. You know, even if you have a good team, some sessions can be busts. You know, but I think that. Well, the way that we kind of approached it was Ryan and I were like, well, we know how to write the way that we write. But we're pretty versatile and adaptable. Let's try to write the way that everybody else writes. And let's see how they want to start. Mm. Let's let them start. And then we can, you know, both he and I play a lot of instruments. We both know how to work kind of within different parameters. So we decided to just let the other writers take the lead. And then we were able to, you know, turn the song or whatever the quality of things towards our way of thinking.
Right. And so, and what were some of the, and I know we talked about like the vocal melodies, but like by going that structure, like what did you learn about your own process from letting other people take the lead?
I learned that my process was very narrowing, you know, for me, like that I had never, just all these different ways of making music that I had never really even kind of touched on. And that was exciting. You know, it was really cool to just see how other people were doing it.
And what was, you know, one or two of the ways that, like, other people make music that are like, whoa, I never thought about this, and now it's just coming with you outside of the vocal melody?
Sure. I mean, we wrote this track that's on the record called Lonely World, and that was, we wrote this with this guy who goes by Rich Skills, and he's, like, real, he's a protege of one of the big hip-hop producers, Polo de Don. So he's, like, all he does is hip-hop, really, hip-hop and some R&B. So he had this just, like, massive drum beat and this piano sort of like half progression. You know, it was really very, very bare bones. All it was is piano and like big 808 kick and snare. And for a lot of people might hear that and be like, oh, we just got to get a rapper on this track. Like the beat is hot. Let's just get somebody. But then Ryan and I were like, man, we could take this and put some kind of like 70s soul-ish guitar behind it and make it kind of sound like a Prince thing with a hip-hop beat. So that's sort of what we did. You know, like we heard it in a different light than people maybe in the same wheelhouse as he would. And he was cool enough to just let us kind of take the track and go with it, you know?
So the new record, Nights Like This, is coming up, but you're doing some pre-shows, if you will.
Sure.
And I know you had a couple up in Boston and one at Union Pool, but what are the shows like?
Well, we're doing these shows. We kind of are taking the theme and running with it, Nights Like This with Eli Paperboy Reed. And the goal, at least right now, for before the album comes out, is we're playing. The big thing is myself and the band are playing the entire album, all the new songs, so people can come in here, all the new stuff, even before it's out. We have great DJs who are spinning in between bands. We have a show coming up this Saturday, which is March 22nd at Studio Webster Hall, and some good friends of mine, High and Mighty Brass Band, are supporting, and they're an amazing, amazing band, and they play out on the floor. It's, you know, they have tuba and trombone and all that stuff, so they're really, the goal was to make it more of an event and not just a show that you go to and you pay your $12 and you stay and see the band for 40 minutes and then you leave. You want people to hang out and enjoy the vibe of the thing. You know, that's like what we were trying to get across with the Nights Like This kind of concept.
Do you want to play another new song off the record?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to play one right now. This is one of my favorites. This is my alternate title to the record because I think it is, you know, sort of representative. But this is one that that it was just Ryan and I. We wrote this together on one of our sessions. And this is called Grown Up. It goes like this.
I remember sitting on my living room floor, making sure my mother wasn't coming in the door with the radio blasting, singing. Back in 91, I was having too much fun. There was nothing that could make me stop relaxing. Thought I'd never grow old. How could I be so bold? But I've got a deal now. Shit is getting real, so I put on my shoes and lace up. I know I've got to face up to the breakups and makeups and everything I screwed up. I've got to shape up. There's lost time to make up, mistakes to own up, 'cause now somehow I'm a grown up. Yes, I'm a grown up. How you even know when's it even start? Someone give me lines, 'cause I don't know this part. It seems so easy. Nobody spends their days watching time go by. Close your eyes and jump and hope that you can fly. Can't believe it. Oh, thought I'd never grow old. How could I be so bold? But I've got a deal now. Shit is getting real, so I put on my shoes and lace up. I know I've got to face up to the breakups and makeups and everything I screwed up. I've got to shape up. There's lost time to make up, mistakes to own up, 'cause now somehow I'm a grown up. Yes, I'm a grown up. Thought I'd never grow old. How could I be so bold? But I've got a deal now. Shit is getting real now. Shit is getting real now. So I put on my shoes and lace up. I know I've got to face up to the breakups and makeups and everything I screwed up. I've got to shape up. There's lost time to make up, mistakes to own up, 'cause now somehow I put on my shoes and lace up. I know I've got to face up to the breakups and makeups and everything I screwed up. I've got to shape up this lost time to make up, mistakes to own up, 'cause now somehow I'm a grown up. Oh yeah, yes I'm a grown up. Yes I'm a grown up. Oh I'm a grown up. Hey.
Yes.
Thank you.
I feel like that song is trying to send a message, but I just can't figure it out.
No, it's
yeah.
a tough one.
Yeah, it's those. It's a really subtle and, you know, really shrouded lyric.
Subtlety was never my strong suit.
I mean, is there any, like, I mean, in, besides, like, hiding the fact that people were just, like, fucking all the time in soul music, was there, like, much subtlety to soul music?
You know, I don't think so. And I kind of don't think that's really what it's all about. You know, I'm... You know, to be perfectly honest with you, not really a fan of music that has too many subtleties, whether it's emotional or not. I think that there's a place for it, don't get me wrong, and I'm not going to say there isn't. I'm, you know, I've sort of always been a hard-on-my-sleeve kind of person. I think that I do enjoy tongue-in-cheek lyrics. I enjoy lyrics that can be funny or interpreted in a couple of different ways, but for the most part, I'm not writing poetry.
Right.
And I'm okay with that. That's me, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, you gotta. I mean, you have to know your place.
I'm a meat and potatoes kind of guy.
That's fine. So, you know, along with a new record comes a tour.
Yes.
So, where are you heading out to?
Well, after we do this show, this will be the last New York show, March 22nd, I want to say again, Webster Hall, which is coming up this Saturday, less than a week. This will be the last show in New York before the record comes out. And then less than a month from then, we head to Europe. We're going to be in Europe basically from April 22nd through June 9th with a little bit of a break in between.
Okay.
But yeah, we're going Ireland, Scotland, England, Holland, Belgium, Switzerland, France, Germany, Italy, Spain.
Some real meat and potato places.
Yeah.
No, and any of them places like close, near, and dear to your heart that you're like, I'm so excited. Come back with welcome open arms.
I love Spain. We do very, very well in Spain, which has been I have a great promoter over in Spain called Heart of Gold, and they've just done an amazing job really helping me to build a career over there. So we can go, and I will go and play in Madrid for, you know, 2,500 people, and it's pretty amazing place to be able to go and hang out.
Eduardo, favorite Spanish wine?
Ooh, a little unsung spot in the northwest part. It's a grape called Mencia.
Sure.
Really light, easy drinking, yeah. So delicious.
He didn't even flinch. Look at that. He was ready.
I'm impressed.
He was ready.
We did actually played when they recently did an unveiling for the white grape in Rioja, and we played at the like they
that's
had a big
awesome.
Event. And
what's the white grape unveiling?
I don't know what that's all about, but you know.
I don't know either.
Yeah. Apparently awesome. They have a white Rioja is generally known for red wine, I would imagine, and they're apparently debuting some sort of genetic anomaly where they have a white Rioja grape.
Oh, sir, I mean, there are whites from Rioja, to be sure, that can be pretty fascinating and compelling wines.
Okay.
And I guess it was
a really
good excuse to play good music.
That's pretty much. I mean, I enjoy Spanish wine. I don't know as much as I would like.
And then are you coming back to the States at all for tour?
Yeah, you know, we'll be back when we get back in June. Basically, that'll be around release time. And the goal is to kind of do these nights like this shows in probably 10 cities in June and July and really kind of slowly break in to coming back to. It's actually been a very, very long time since I've toured extensively in the U.S. So I think the goal is to really try to get some music out there, whether it's on the radio or whatever, and then use that as a springboard to getting back on the road here in America.
That's great.
My real goal.
And you're playing in Philly on Friday.
On Philly on Thursday, we're doing like a little bit of a kind of an intimate evening with Eli Favorite Reed, with just me and a couple other guys doing some tunes from the new record. But it's not the full on nights like this. But if you're in Philly, you should come out and see us at the Prince Theater on Thursday, which is the 20th.
Amazing. Well, before we have you play one more tune, where can people find you? Sign up for email list. pre-order the record, etc.
Absolutely. Well, you can. The best place, I think, is to hit me up on Twitter, which is just at Eli Paperboy Reed, all one word, two E's at the end. Facebook is good, too. Facebook.com/EliPaperboyReed. The website is a thing that exists. I don't really know who runs it, but Twitter and Facebook are always good. I'm on Twitter. If you hit me up, I will hit you back. And yeah, record comes out April 29th. Shock to the System, which I just played, is out on iTunes right now, so you can go and buy that. It sounds really good. It sounds better than just me and a guitar, I promise.
It sounds pretty good here.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
I mean, I have to say that you were one of the first performances where, when we started to look back and be like, oh, I actually think we can start making comps of all the live performances. It was like one of your performance with like the with that and the fork on the plate percussion, which was like, I think, just like a happy accident after we finished eating.
I feel like it was just somebody just like, whoever was, and maybe somebody else was in here and decided to just use the fork in the plate. Unless it was on the floor.
It was on the floor.
Was I just stomping on it?
You were just stomping, and I was like, oh, that sounds actually.
I think that's what it was. Yeah. You know, I missed that. We should have done that.
Next time. Hopefully in less than 4 years for the next record.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I also want to thank our other guest, Eduardo from DBGB. Thank you so much for spending your day off with us.
Thank you. So much fun.
Yeah, and so stay tuned next week for another episode of Snacky Tunes. I will not be here, but Darren will be taking my place. And then we'll be back in 2 weeks for a very special birthday edition. We have the Richard Jenkins, who is a... do you know him? Okay.
I know of him. I don't know him.
He is like old school piano player from around New York, like Carlisle type vibes. So
that'd be fun.
We thought that'd be really amazing. All right, Eli, well, what are you going to take us out with?
We're going to do one. This is my favorite ballad on the record. I'm a big ballad guy, and we had to have one real powerful ballad, and this is called Two Broken Hearts.
Wait, and who wrote that? Did you write the ballad, or did you have help on it?
Oh, I wrote the ballad. Yeah. Okay. I write all the ballads. most of the lyrics are mine, but this is one of this is probably my favorite song on the record, although I have to say that about all of them. Anyway, Two Broken Hearts.
Still haven't cried. Everything that you took from me, you still can't take my pride. You told me all your secrets, and girl, I told you mine. Regrets if I get some off my mind. So baby, stand back, it's a heart attack. Gonna use your words to get you back. Pretty soon you'll see misery loves company. Keeping all your secrets just ain't no fun. Two broken hearts are better. I've just begun. Two broken hearts are better than one. I tried keeping us together, but you kept pulling us apart. Looking back, I knew that you were troubled from the start. You thought that you could break me, yeah, but I'm stronger than before. Yeah, you might think that you can take me, but girl, I'm gonna start a war. Gonna use your words to get you back. Pretty soon you'll see misery loves company. Keeping all your secrets just ain't no fun. Two broken hearts are better than one. You said it's over, but I've just begun. Everybody. everybody's gonna know. True colors are gonna show. Pretty soon everybody's gonna know. True colors are gonna show. Pretty soon everybody's gonna know. True colors are gonna show. Pretty soon you'll see. Misery loves company. Keeping all your secrets just ain't no fun. True broken hearts.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for
listening. Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.